Chapter 15. Strangers and Friends. Sunlight streaming across his narrow bed finally woke Rand out of a deep but restless sleep. He pulled a pillow over his head, but it did not really shut out the light, and he did not really want to go back to sleep. There had been more dreams after the first. He could not remember any but the first, but he knew he wanted no more. With a sigh, he tossed the pillow aside and sat up, wincing as he stretched. All the aches he thought had soaked out in the bath were back, and his head still hurt, too. It did not surprise him. A dream like that was enough to give anybody a headache. The others had already faded, but not that one. The other beds were empty. Light poured in through the window at a steep angle. The sun stood well above the horizon. By this hour back on the farm, he would have already fixed something to eat and been well into his chores. He scrambled out of bed, muttering angrily to himself. A city to see, and they did not even wake him. At least someone had seen that there was water in the pitcher, and still warm, too. He washed and dressed quickly, hesitating a moment over Tam's sword. Lan and Tom had left their saddlebags and blanket rolls behind in the room, of course, but the warder's sword was nowhere to be seen. Lan had worn his sword in Emmons Field even before there was any hint of trouble. He thought he would take the older man's lead, telling himself it was not because he had often daydreamed about walking the streets of a real city wearing a sword. He belted it on and tossed his cloak over his shoulder like a sack. Taking the stairs two at a time, he hurried down to the kitchen. That was surely the quickest place to get a bite, and on his only day in Berlon, he did not want to waste any more time than he already had. Blood and ashes, but they could have waked me. Master Fitch was in the kitchen, confronting a plump woman whose arms were covered in flour to her elbows, obviously the cook. Rather, she was confronting him, shaking her finger under his nose. Serving maids and scullions, potboys and spitboys, hurried about their tasks, elaborately ignoring what was going on in front of them.
"Messiri is a good cat," the cook was saying sharply, "and I won't hear a word otherwise, do you hear? Complaining about him doing his job too well, that's what you're doing if you ask me."
"I have had complaints," Master Fitch managed to get in.
"Complaints, mistress. Half the guests.
I won't hear of it. I just won't hear of it. If they want to complain about my cat, let them do the cooking. Me poor old cat, who's just doing his job, and me, we'll go somewhere where we're appreciated, see if we don't."
She untied her apron and started to lift it over her head.
"No!"
Master Fitch yelped and leaped to stop her. They danced in a circle with the cook trying to take her apron off and the innkeeper trying to put it back on her.
"No, Sarah," he panted. "There's no need for this. No need, I say. What would I do without you? Ciri's a fine cat. An excellent cat. He's the best cat in Berlon. If anyone else complains, I'll tell them to be thankful the cat is doing his job. Yes, thankful. You mustn't go. Sarah! Sarah!"
The cook stopped their circling and managed to snatch her apron free of him.
"All right, then, all right."
Clutching the apron in both hands, she still did not retie it.
"But if you expect me to have anything ready for midday, you'd best get out of here and let me get to it. This may be your inn, but it's me kitchen. Unless you want to do the cooking."
She made as if to hand the apron to him. Master Fitch stepped back with his hands spread wide. He opened his mouth, then stopped, looking around for the first time. The kitchen help still studiously ignored the cook and the innkeeper, and Rand began an intensive search of his coat pockets, though except for the coin Moraine had given him, there was nothing in them but a few coppers and a handful of odds and ends. His pocket knife and sharpening stone, two spare bowstrings and a piece of string he had thought might be useful.
"I am sure, Sarah," Master Fitch said carefully, "that everything will be up to your usual excellence."
With that, he took one last suspicious look at the kitchen help, then left with as much dignity as he could manage. Sarah waited until he was gone before briskly tying her apron strings again, then fastened her eye on Rand.
"I suppose you want something to eat, eh?
Well, come on in."
She gave him a quick grin.
"I don't bite, I don't. No matter what you may have seen, as you shouldn't.
Seal, get the lad some bread and cheese and milk. That's all there is right now. Sit yourself, lad. Your friends have all gone out, except one lad I understand wasn't feeling well, and I expect you'll be wanting to do the same."
One of the serving maids brought a tray while Rand took a stool at the table. He began eating as the cook went back to kneading her bread dough, but she was not finished talking.
"You mustn't take any mind of what you saw now. Master Fitch is a good enough man, though the best of you aren't any bargains. It's the folk complaining as has him on edge. And what do they have to complain about? Would they rather find live rats than dead ones? Though it isn't like Ciri to leave his handiwork behind. And over a dozen? Ciri wouldn't let so many get into the inn. He wouldn't. It's a clean place, too, and not one to be so troubled. And all with backs broken. She shook her head at the strangeness of it all. The bread and cheese turned to ashes in Rand's mouth. Their backs were broken? The cook waved a flowery hand. Think on happier things. That's my way of looking. There's a gleeman, you know, in the common room right this minute. But then you came with him, didn't you? You're one of those as came with Mistress Alice last evening, aren't you? I thought you were. I won't get much chance to see this gleeman myself, I'm thinking. Not with the inn as full as it is, and most of them riff-raff down from the mines.
She gave the dough an especially heavy thump.
Not the sort we'd let in most times, only the whole town is filled up with them. Better than some they could be, though, I suppose. Why, I haven't seen a gleeman since before the winter, and...
Rand ate mechanically, not tasting anything, not listening to what the cook said. Dead rats with their backs broken. He finished his breakfast hastily, stammered his thanks, and hurried out. He had to talk to someone. The common room of the Stag and Lion shared little except its purpose with the same room at the Winespring Inn. It was twice as wide and three times as long, and colorful pictures of ornate buildings with gardens of tall trees and bright flowers were painted high on the walls. Instead of one huge fireplace, a hearth blazed on each wall, and scores of tables filled the floor, with almost every chair, bench, or stool taken. Every man among the crowd of patrons, with pipes in their teeth and mugs in their fists, leaned forward with his attention on one thing. Tom, standing atop a table in the middle of the room, his many-colored cloak tossed over a nearby chair. Even Master Fitch held a silver tankard and a polishing cloth in motionless hands.
"Prancing silver hooves and proud arched necks," Tom proclaimed, while somehow seeming not only to be riding a horse, but to be one of a long procession of riders. "Silken manes flutter with tossed heads. A thousand streaming banners whip rainbows against an endless sky. A hundred brazen-throated trumpets shiver the air, and drums rattle like thunder. Wave on wave, cheers roll from watchers in their thousands, roll across the rooftops and towers of Ilion, crash and break unheard around the thousand ears of riders whose eyes and hearts shine with their sacred quest. The great hunt of the horn rides forth. Rides to seek the horn of Valir, that will summon the heroes of the ages back from the grave to battle for the light."
It was what the gleeman had called plain chant, those nights beside the fire on the ride north. Stories, he said, were told in three voices, high chant, plain chant, and common, which meant simply telling it the way you might tell your neighbor about your crop. Tom told stories in common, but he did not bother to hide his contempt for the voice. Rand closed the door without going in and slumped against the wall. He would get no advice from Tom. Moraine? What would she do if she knew? He became aware of people staring at him as they passed and realized he was muttering under his breath. Smoothing his coat, he straightened. He had to talk to somebody. The cook had said one of the others had not gone out. It was an effort not to run. When he rapped on the door of the room where the other boys had slept and poked his head in, only Perrin was there, lying on his bed and still not dressed. He twisted his head on the pillow to look at Rand, then closed his eyes again. Matt's bow and quiver were propped in the corner. "I heard you weren't feeling well," Rand said. He came in and sat on the next bed. "I just wanted to talk. I..." He did not know how to bring it up, he realized. "If you're sick," he said, half standing, "maybe you ought to sleep. I can go." "I don't know if I'll ever sleep again," Perrin sighed. "I had a bad dream, if you must know, and couldn't get back to sleep. Matt will be quick enough to tell you. He laughed this morning when I told them why I was too tired to go out with him. But he dreamed too. I listened to him for most of the night, tossing and muttering. And you can't tell me he got a good night's sleep." He threw a thick arm across his eyes. "Light, but I'm tired. Maybe if I just stay here for an hour or two, I'll feel like getting up. Matt will never let me hear the end of it if I miss seeing Bearlum because of a dream. Rand slowly lowered himself to the bed again. He licked his lips, then said quickly, "Did he kill a rat?" Perrin lowered his arm and stared at him.
"You too," he said finally.
When Rand nodded, he said,
"I wish I was back home." He told me. He said, "What are we going to do? Have you told Moraine?" "No, not yet. Maybe I won't, I don't know. What about you?" He said, "Blood and ashes, Rand. I don't know."
Perrin raised up on his elbows abruptly.
"Do you think Matt had the same dream?" He laughed, but it sounded forced, and he looked funny when I said I couldn't sleep because of a dream.
"Maybe he did," Rand said. Guiltily, he felt relieved he was not the only one. "I was going to ask Tom for advice. He's seen a lot of the world. You don't think we should tell Moraine, do you?"
Perrin fell back on his pillow.
"You've heard the stories about Aes Sedai. Do you think we can trust Tom?
If we can trust anybody.
Rand, if we get out of this alive, if we ever get back home, and you hear me say anything about leaving Emmons Field, even to go as far as Watch Hill, you kick me, all right?"
"That's no way to talk," Rand said. He put on a smile, as cheerful as he could make it.
"Of course we'll get home. Come on, get up. We're in a city, and we have a whole day to see it. Where are your clothes?"
"You go. I just want to lie here a while."
Perrin put his arm back across his eyes.
"You go ahead. I'll catch you up in an hour or two."
"It's your loss," Rand said as he got up. "Think of what you might miss." He stopped at the door.
"Bearlon. How many times have we talked about seeing Bearlon one day?"
Perrin lay there with his eyes covered and did not say a word. After a minute, Rand stepped out and closed the door behind him. In the hallway, he leaned against the wall, his smile fading. His head still hurt. It was worse, not better. He could not work up much enthusiasm for Bearlon either, not now. He could not summon enthusiasm about anything. A chambermaid came by, her arms full of sheets, and gave him a concerned look. Before she could speak, he moved off down the hall, shrugging into his cloak. Tom would not be finished in the common room for hours yet. He might as well see what he could. Perhaps he could find Matt and see if Baal-Zaman had been in his dreams too. He went downstairs more slowly this time, rubbing his temple. The stairs ended near the kitchen, so he took that way out, nodding to Sarah, but hurrying on when she seemed about to take up where she had left off. The stable yard was empty except for Much, standing in the stable door, and one of the ostlers, carrying a sack on his shoulder into the stable. Rand nodded to Much too, but the stableman gave him a truculent look and went inside. He hoped the rest of the city was more like Sarah and less like Much. Ready to see what a city was like, he picked up his step. At the open stable yard gates, he stopped and stared. People packed the street like sheep in a pen. People swathed to the eyes in cloaks and coats, hats pulled down against the cold, weaving in and out at a quick step, as though the wind whistling over the rooftops blew them along, elbowing past one another with barely a word or a glance. All strangers, he thought. None of them know each other.
The smells were strange, too, sharp and sour and sweet, all mixed in a hodgepodge that had him rubbing his nose. Even at the height of festival, he had never seen so many people so jammed together. Not even half so many. And this was only one street. Master Fitch and the cook said the whole city was full.
The whole city? Like this?
He backed slowly away from the gate, away from the street full of people. It really was not right to go off and leave Perrin sick in bed. And what if Tom finished his storytelling while Rand was off in the city? The gleeman might go out himself, and Rand needed to talk to someone. Much better to wait a bit. He breathed a sigh of relief as he turned his back on the swarming street. Going back inside the inn did not appeal to him, though, not with his headache. He sat on an upended barrel against the back of an inn and hoped the cold air might help his head. Much came to the stable door from time to time to stare at him, and even across the stable yard he could make out the fellow's disapproving scowl. Was it country people the man did not like?
or had he been embarrassed by Master Fitch greeting them after he had tried to chase them off from coming in the back way? Maybe he's a dark friend, he thought, expecting to chuckle at the idea, but it was not a funny thought. He rubbed his hand along the hilt of Tam's sword. There was not much left that was funny at all. "A shepherd with a heron marked sword," said a low woman's voice. "That's almost enough to make me believe anything. What trouble are you in, down country boy?" Startled, Rand jumped to his feet. It was the crop-haired young woman who had been with Moraine when he came out of the bath chamber, still dressed in a boy's coat and breeches. She was a little older than he was, he thought, with dark eyes, even bigger than Egwene's, and oddly intent. "You are Rand, aren't you?" she went on. "My name is Min." "I'm not in trouble," he said. He did not know what Moraine had told her, but he remembered Lan's admonition not to attract any notice. "What makes you think I'm in trouble? The Two Rivers is a quiet place, and we're all quiet people. No place for trouble, unless it has to do with crops or sheep."
"Quiet?"
Min said with a faint smile.
"I've heard men talk about you Two Rivers folk. I've heard the jokes about wooden-headed sheep herders, and then there are men who have actually been down country."
"Wooden-headed," Rand said, frowning. "What jokes?"
"The ones who know," she went on as if he had not spoken, "say you walk around all smiles and politeness, just as meek and soft as butter. On the surface, anyway. Underneath, they say, you're all as tough as old oak roots. Prod too hard, they say, and you dig up stone. But the stone isn't buried very deep in you or in your friends. It's as if a storm has scoured away almost all the covering. Moraine didn't tell me everything, but I see what I see." "Old oak roots? Stone?"
It hardly sounded like the sort of thing the merchants or their people would say. That last made him jump, though. He looked around quickly. The stable yard was empty, and the nearest windows were closed. "I don't know anybody named... what was it again?"
"Mistress Alice, then, if you prefer," Min said, with an amused look that made his cheeks color. "There's no one close enough to hear."
"What makes you think Mistress Alice has another name?"
"Because she told me," Min said,
so patiently that he blushed again.
"Not that she had a choice, I suppose. I saw she was different right away. When she stopped here before on her way down country. She knew about me. I've talked to others like her before."
"Saw," Rand said.
"Well, I don't suppose you'll go running to the children, not considering who your traveling companions are. The White Cloaks wouldn't like what I do any more than they like what she does.
I don't understand."
"She says I see pieces of the pattern."
Min gave a little laugh and shook her head.
"Sounds too grand to me. I just see things when I look at people, and sometimes I know what they mean. I look at a man and a woman who've never even talked to one another, and I know they'll marry, and they do. That sort of thing."
"She wanted me to look at you. All of you together." Rand shivered. "And what did you see?"
"When you're all in a group, sparks swirling around you. Thousands of them. And a big shadow, darker than midnight.
It's so strong, I almost wonder why everybody can't see it. The sparks are trying to fill the shadow, and the shadow is trying to swallow the sparks."
She shrugged.
"You are all tied together in something dangerous, but I can't make any more of it."
"All of us?" Rand muttered. "Egwene, too? But they weren't after, I mean..." Min did not seem to notice his slip.
"The girl? She's part of it. And the Gleeman. All of you. You're in love with her."
He stared at her. "I can tell that even without seeing any images."
"She loves you, too. But she's not for you, or you for her. Not the way you both want."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"When I look at her, I see the same as when I look at Mistress Alice. Other things, things I don't understand, too, but I know what that means. She won't refuse it."
"This is all foolishness," Rand said uncomfortably.
His headache was fading to numbness. His head felt packed with wool. He wanted to get away from this girl and the things she saw. And yet...
What do you see when you look at the rest of us?
All sorts of things, Min said, with a grin as if she knew what he really wanted to ask.
The Master Andra has 7 ruined towers around his head, and a babe in a cradle holding a sword, and...
She shook her head. Men like him, you understand, always have so many images they crowd one another. The strongest images around the Gleeman are a man, not him, juggling fire, and the White Tower. And that doesn't make any sense at all for a man. The strongest things I see about the big curly-haired fellow are a wolf and a broken crown and trees flowering all around him. And the other one, a red eagle, an eye on a balance scale, a dagger with a ruby, a horn, and a laughing face. There are other things, but you see what I mean. This time I can't make up or down out of any of it.
She waited then, still grinning, until he finally cleared his throat and asked,
What about me?
Her grin stopped just short of outright laughter.
The same kind of things as the rest. A sword that isn't a sword, a golden crown of laurel leaves, a beggar's staff, you pouring water on sand,
a bloody hand and a white-hot iron, 3 women standing over a funeral bier with you on it, black rock wet with blood.
All right, he broke in uneasily. You don't have to list it all.
Most of all, I see lightning around you. Some striking at you, some coming out of you. I don't know what any of it means, except for one thing. You and I will meet again.
She gave him a quizzical look, as if she did not understand that either.
Why shouldn't we? He said. I'll be coming back this way on my way home.
I suppose you will at that.
Suddenly her grin was back, wry and mysterious, and she patted his cheek.
But if I told you everything I saw, you'd be as curly-haired as your friend with the shoulders.
He jerked back from her hand as if it were red hot.
What do you mean? Do you see anything about rats or dreams?
Rats? No, no rats. As for dreams, maybe it's your idea of a dream, but I never thought it was mine.
He wondered if she was crazy, grinning like that. I have to go, he said, edging around her. I have to meet my friends.
Go then. But you won't escape.
He didn't exactly break into a run, but every step he took was quicker than the step before.
Run if you want, she called after him. You can't escape me.
Her laughter sped him across the stable yard and out into the street, into the hubbub of people. Her last words were too close to what Baalzamon had said. He blundered into people as he hurried through the crowd, earning hard looks and hard words, but he did not slow down until he was several streets away from the inn. After a time, he began to pay attention again to where he was. His head felt like a balloon, but he stared and enjoyed anyway. He thought Berlon was a grand city, if not exactly in the same way as cities in Tom's stories. He wandered up broad streets, most paved with flagstone, and down narrow, twisting lanes, wherever chance and the shifting of the crowd took him. It had rained during the night, and the streets that were unpaved had already been churned to mud by the crowds, but muddy streets were nothing new to him. None of the streets in Emmons Field were paved. There certainly were no palaces, and only a few houses were very much bigger than those back home. But every house had a roof of slate or tile, as fine as the roof of the Winespring Inn. He supposed there would be a palace or two in Camelin. As for inns, he counted 9. Not one smaller than the Winespring, and most as large as the Stag and Lion, and there were plenty of streets he had not seen yet. Shops dotted every street, with awnings out front sheltering tables covered with goods, everything from cloth to books to pots to boots. It was as if 100 peddlers' wagons had spilled out their contents. He stared so much that more than once he had to hurry on at the suspicious look of a shopkeeper. He had not understood the first shopkeeper's stare. When he did, he started to get angry until he remembered that here he was the stranger. He could not have bought much anyway. He gasped when he saw how many coppers were exchanged for a dozen discolored apples or a handful of shriveled turnips, the sort that would be fed to the horses in the two rivers. But people seemed eager to pay. There were certainly more than enough people to his estimation. For a while, the sheer number of them almost overwhelmed him. Some wore clothes of finer cut than anyone in the two rivers, almost as fine as Moraine's. And quite a few had long fur-lined coats that flapped around their ankles. The miners everybody at the inn kept talking about, they had the hunched look of men who grubbed underground. But most of the people did not look any different from those he had grown up with, not in dress or in face. He had expected they would, somehow. Indeed, some of them had so much the look of the two rivers in their faces that he could imagine they belonged to one family or another that he knew around Emmons Field. A toothless, gray-haired fellow with ears like jug handles, sitting on a bench outside one of the inns and peering mournfully into an empty tankard, could easily have been Billy Conger's close cousin. The lantern-jawed tailor, sewing in front of his shop, might have been John Thane's brother, even to the same bald spot on the back of his head. A near-mirror image of Samuel Craw pushed past Rand as he turned a corner and, in disbelief, he stared at a bony little man with long arms and a big nose, shoving hurriedly through the crowd in clothes that looked like a bundle of rags. The man's eyes were sunken and his dirty face gaunt, as if he had not eaten or slept in days, but Rand could swear. The ragged man saw him then, and froze in mid-step, heedless of people who all but stumbled over him. The last doubt in Rand's mind vanished.
"Master Fane!" he shouted. "We all thought you were—"
As quick as a blink, the peddler darted away, but Rand dodged after him, calling apologies over his shoulder to the people he bumped. Through the crowd, he just caught sight of Fane dashing into an alleyway, and he turned after. A few steps into the alleyway, the peddler had stopped in his tracks. A tall fence made it into a dead end. As Rand skidded to a halt, Fane rounded on him, crouching warily and backing away. He flapped grimy hands at Rand to stay back. More than one rip showed in his coat, and his cloak was worn and tattered, as if it had seen much harder use than it was meant for.
"Master Fane," Rand said hesitantly. "What is the matter? It's me, Randall Thor, from Emmons Field. We all thought the Trollocs had taken you."
Fane gestured sharply and, still in a crouch, ran a few crabbed steps toward the open end of the alley. He did not try to pass Rand, or even come close to him.
"Don't!"
he rasped. His head shifted constantly as he tried to see everything in the street beyond Rand.
"Don't mention,"
his voice dropped into a hoarse whisper, and he turned his head away, watching Rand with quick, sidelong glances.
"Them. There be white cloaks in the town."
"They have no reason to bother us," Rand said. "Come back to the Stag and Lion with me. I'm staying there with friends. You know most of them. They'll be glad to see you. We all thought you were dead."
"Dead?" the peddler snapped indignantly. "Not Padon Fane. Padon Fane knows which way to jump and where to land."
He straightened his rags as if they were feast day clothes.
"Always have and always will. I'll live a long time. Longer than—"
Abruptly his face tightened and his hands clutched hold of his coat front.
"They burned my wagon and all my goods. Had no cause to be doing that, did they? I couldn't get to my horses. My horses. But that fat old innkeeper had them locked up in his stable. I had to step quick not to get my throat slit. And what did it get me? All that I've got left is what I stand up in. Now is that fair? Is it now?"
"Your horses are safe in Master Alvear's stable. You can get them any time. If you come to the inn with me, I'm sure Moraine will help you get back to the two rivers."
"Ah, she's the Aes Sedai, is she?"
A guarded look came over Fane's face.
"Maybe, though."
He paused, licking his lips nervously.
"How long will you be at this? What was it? What did you call it? The Stag and Lion?"
"We leave tomorrow," Rand said.
"Well, what does that have to do with—" "You just don't know," Fane whined. "Standing there with a full belly and a good night's sleep and a soft bed. I've hardly slept a wink since that night. My boots are all worn out with running, and as for what I've had to eat—"
His face twisted.
"I don't want to be within miles of an Aes Sedai."
He spat the last words.
Not miles and miles. But I may have to. I've no choice, have I?
The thought of her eyes on me, of her even knowing where I am. He reached toward Rand as if he wanted to grab his coat, but his hands stopped short, fluttering, and he actually took a step back.
Promise me you won't tell her. She frightens me. There's no need to be telling her. No reason for an Aes Sedai to even be knowing I'm alive. You have to promise. You have to!
I promise, Rand said soothingly. But there's no reason for you to be afraid of her. Come with me. The least you'll get is a hot meal.
Maybe, maybe.
Fane rubbed his chin pensively.
Tomorrow, you say. In that time...
You won't forget your promise. You won't be letting her...
I won't let her hurt you, Rand said, wondering how he could stop an Aes Sedai, whatever she wanted to do.
She won't hurt me, Fane said. No, she won't. I won't be letting her.
Like a flash, he haired past Rand into the crowd.
Master Fane, Rand called. Wait!
He dashed out of the alley just in time to catch sight of a ragged coat disappearing around the next corner. Still calling, he ran after it, darted around the corner. He only had time to see a man's back before he crashed into it, and they both went down in a heap in the mud.
Can't you watch where you're going?
Came a mutter from under him, and Rand scrambled up in surprise.
Matt?
Matt sat up with a baleful glare and began scraping mud off his cloak with his hands.
You must really be turning into a city man. Sleep all morning and run right over people.
Climbing to his feet, he stared at his muddy hands, then muttered and wiped them off on his cloak.
Listen, you'll never guess who I thought I just saw.
Padan Fane, Rand said.
Padan Fane!
How did you know?
I was talking to him, but he ran off. So the
Matt stopped to look around warily, but the crowd was passing them by with never a glance. Rand was glad he had learned a little caution.
So they didn't get him. I wonder why he left Emmons Field without a word like that. Probably started running then, too, and didn't stop until he got here. But why was he running just now?
Rand shook his head and wished he had not. It felt as though it might fall off.
I don't know, except that he's afraid of Mistress Alice.
All this watching what you said was not easy. He doesn't want her to know he's here. He made me promise I wouldn't tell her.
Well, his secret is safe with me, Matt said.
I wish he didn't know where I was either.
Matt.
People still streamed by without paying them any heed, but Rand lowered his voice anyway and leaned closer.
Matt, did you have a nightmare last night about a man who killed a rat?
Matt stared at him without blinking.
You too,
he said finally.
And Perrin, I suppose. I almost asked him this morning, but he must have. Blood and ashes. Now somebody's making us dream things. Rand, I wish nobody knew where I was.
There were dead rats all over the inn this morning. He did not feel as afraid at saying it as he would have earlier. He did not feel much of anything.
Their backs were broken.
His voice rang in his own ears. If he was getting sick, he might have to go to Moraine. He was surprised that even the thought of the one power being used on him did not bother him. Matt took a deep breath, hitching his cloak, and looked around as if searching for somewhere to go.
What's happening to us, Rand? What?
I don't know.
I'm going to ask Tom for advice about whether to tell anyone else. No, not her. Maybe him, but not her.
The sharpness of it took Rand by surprise.
Then you believed him.
He did not need to say which him he meant. The grimace on Matt's face said he understood.
No, Matt said slowly. It's the chances, that's all. If we tell her and he was lying, then maybe nothing happens. Maybe. But maybe just him being in our dreams is enough for... I don't know.
He stopped to swallow.
If we don't tell her, maybe we'll have some more dreams. Rats or no rats, dreams are better than... Remember the fairy? I say we keep quiet.
All right. Rand remembered the fairy, and Moraine's threat, too. But somehow it seemed a long time ago. All right.
Perrin won't say anything, will he?
Matt went on, bouncing on his toes.
We have to get back to him. If he tells her, she'll figure it out about all of us. You can bet on it. Come on.
He started off briskly through the crowd. Rand stood there looking after him until Matt came back and grabbed him. At the touch of his arm, he blinked, then followed his friend.
What's the matter with you? Matt asked. You going to sleep again?
I think I have a cold, Rand said.
His head was as tight as a drum and almost as empty.
You can get some chicken soup when we get back to the inn, Matt said.
He kept up a constant chatter as they hunted through the packed streets. Rand made an effort to listen, and even to say something now and then, but it was an effort.
He was not tired. He did not want to sleep. He just felt as if he were drifting.
After a while, he found himself telling Matt about Min.
A dagger with a ruby, eh? Matt said. I like that. I don't know about the eye, though.
Are you sure she wasn't making it up?
It seems to me she would know what it all means, if she really is a soothsayer.
She didn't say she's a soothsayer, Rand said.
I believe she does see things. Remember, Moraine was talking to her when we finished our baths? And she knows who Moraine is.
Matt frowned at him.
I thought we weren't supposed to use that name.
No, Rand muttered. He rubbed his head with both hands.
It was so hard to concentrate on anything. I think maybe you really are sick, Matt said, still frowning.
Suddenly he pulled Rand to a stop by his coat sleeve.
Look at them.
Three men in breastplates and conical steel caps, burnished till they shone like silver, were making their way down the street toward Rand and Matt. Even the mail on their arms gleamed. Their long cloaks, pristine white and embroidered on the left breast with a golden sunburst, just cleared the mud and puddles of the street. Their hands rested on their sword hilts, and they looked around them as if looking at things that had wriggled out from under a rotting log. Nobody looked back, though. Nobody even seemed to notice them. Just the same, the three did not have to push through the crowd. The bustle parted to either side of the white-cloaked men, as if by happenstance, leaving them to walk in a clear space that moved with them.
"Do you suppose they're children of the light?"
Matt asked in a loud voice. A passerby looked hard at Matt, then quickened his pace. Rand nodded. Children of the light. White cloaks. Men who hated Aes Sedai. Men who told people how to live, causing trouble for those who refused to obey. If burned farms and worse could be called as mild as trouble.
I should be afraid, he thought. Or curious. Something at any rate.
Instead, he stared at them passively.
They don't look like so much to me, Matt said. Full of themselves, though, aren't they?
They don't matter, Rand said. The inn. We have to talk to Perrin.
Like Edward Conger. He always has his nose in the air, too.
Suddenly Matt grinned, a twinkle in his eye.
Remember when he fell off the wagon bridge and had to tramp home dripping wet? That took him down a peg for a month.
What does that have to do with Perrin?
See that?
Matt pointed to a cart resting on its shafts in an alleyway just ahead of the children. A single stake held a dozen stacked barrels in place in the flatbed.
Watch.
Laughing, he darted into a cutler's shop to their left. Rand stared after him, knowing he should do something. That look in Matt's eyes always meant one of his tricks. But oddly, he found himself looking forward to whatever Matt was going to do. Something told him that feeling was wrong, that it was dangerous, but he smiled in anticipation anyway. In a minute, Matt appeared above him, climbing half out of an attic window onto the tile roof of the shop. His sling was in his hands, already beginning to whirl. Rand's eyes went back to the cart. Almost immediately, there was a sharp crack, and the stake holding the barrels broke just as the white cloaks came abreast of the alley. People jumped out of the way as the barrels rolled down the cart shafts with an empty rumble and jounced into the street, splashing mud and muddy water in every direction. The three children jumped no less quickly than anyone else, their superior looks replaced by surprise. Some passers-by fell down, making more splashes, but the three moved agilely, avoiding the barrels with ease. They could not avoid the flying mud that splattered their white cloaks, though. A bearded man in a long apron hurried out of the alley, waving his arms and shouting angrily. But one look at the three trying vainly to shake the mud from their cloaks, and he vanished back into the alley even faster than he had come out. Rand glanced back up at the shop roof. Matt was gone. It had been an easy shot for any Two Rivers lad, but the effect was certainly all that could be hoped for. He could not help laughing. The humor seemed to be wrapped in wool, but it was still funny. When he turned back to the street, the three white cloaks were staring straight at him.
"You find something funny, yes?"
The one who spoke stood a little in front of the others. He wore an arrogant, unblinking look, with a light in his eyes as if he knew something important. Something no one else knew. Rand's laughter cut off short. He and the children were alone with the mud in the barrels. The crowd that had been all around them had found urgent business up or down the street.
"Does fear of the light hold your tongue?"
Anger made the white cloak's narrow face seem even more pinched. He glanced dismissively at the sword hilt sticking out from Rand's cloak.
"Perhaps you are responsible for this, yes?"
Unlike the others, he had a golden knot beneath the sunburst on his cloak. Rand moved to cover the sword, but instead swept his cloak back over his shoulder. In the back of his head was a frantic wonder at what he was doing, but it was a distant thought.
"Accidents happen," he said, "even to the children of the light."
The narrow-faced man raised an eyebrow.
"You are that dangerous, youngling."
He was not much older than Rand. "Heronmark, Lord Bornhold," one of the others said warningly. The narrow-faced man glanced at Rand's sword hilt again. The bronze heron was plain, and his eyes widened momentarily. Then his gaze rose to Rand's face, and he sniffed dismissively.
"He is too young." "You are not from this place, yes?"
he said coldly to Rand.
"You come from where?"
"I just arrived in Berlon." A tingling thrill ran along Rand's arms and legs. He felt flushed, almost warm.
"You wouldn't know of a good inn, would you?"
"You avoid my questions," Bornhold snapped. "What evil is in you that you do not answer me?"
His companions moved up to either side of him, faces hard and expressionless. Despite the mudstains on their cloaks, there was nothing funny about them now. The tingling filled Rand. The heat had grown to a fever. He wanted to laugh, it felt so good. A small voice in his head shouted that something was wrong, but all he could think of was how full of energy he felt, nearly bursting with it. Smiling, he rocked on his heels and waited for what was going to happen. Vaguely, distantly, he wondered what it would be. The leader's face darkened. One of the others drew his sword enough for an inch of steel to show and spoke in a voice quivering with anger. "When the children of the light ask questions, you gray-eyed bumpkin, we expect answers or—" He cut off as the narrow-faced man threw an arm across his chest. Bornhold jerked his head up the street. The town watch had arrived. A dozen men in round steel caps and studded leather jerkins, carrying quarterstaffs, as if they knew how to use them. They stood watching, silently, from 10 paces off.
"This town has lost the light," growled the man, who had half-drawn his sword.
He raised his voice to shout at the watch.
"Berlon stands in the shadow of the Dark One!"
At a gesture from Bornhold, he slammed his blade back into its scabbard. Bornhold turned his attention back to Rand. The light of knowing burned in his eyes.
"Dark friends do not escape us, youngling, even in a town that stands in the shadow. We will meet again, you may be sure of it."
He spun on his heel and strode away, his two companions close behind as if Rand had ceased to exist. For the moment, at least. When they reached the crowded part of the street, the same seemingly accidental pocket as before opened around them. The watchmen hesitated, eyeing Rand, then shouldered their quarterstaffs and followed the white-cloaked three. They had to push their way into the crowd, shouting, "Make way for the watch!" Few did make way, except grudgingly. Rand still rocked on his heels, waiting. The tingle was so strong that he almost quivered. He felt as if he were burning up. Matt came out of the shop, staring at him.
"You aren't sick," he said finally. "You are crazy."
Rand drew a deep breath, and abruptly, it was all gone like a pricked bubble. He staggered as it vanished, the realization of what he had just done flooding in on him. Licking his lips, he met Matt's stare.
"I think we had better go back to the inn now," he said unsteadily.
"Yes," Matt said. "Yes, I think we better had."
The street had begun to fill up again, and more than one passerby stared at the two boys and murmured something to a companion. Rand was sure the story would spread. A crazy man had tried to start a fight with three children of the light. That was something to talk about.
Maybe the dreams are driving me crazy.
The two lost their way several times in the haphazard streets, but after a while, they fell in with Tom Marilyn, making a grand procession all by himself through the throng. The gleeman said he was out to stretch his legs and for a bit of fresh air, but whenever anyone looked twice at his colorful cloak, he would announce in a resounding voice,
"I am at the Stag and Lion, tonight only."
It was Matt who began disjointedly telling Tom about the dream and their worry over whether or not to tell Moraine. But Rand joined in, for there were differences in exactly how they remembered it.
Or maybe each dream was a little different, he thought.
The major part of the dreams was the same, though. They had not gone far in the telling before Tom started paying full attention. When Rand mentioned Baal Zemon, the gleeman grabbed them each by a shoulder with a command to hold their tongues, raised on tiptoe to look over the heads of the crowd, then hustled them out of the press to a dead-end alley that was empty, except for a few crates and a slat-ribbed yellow dog huddled out of the cold. Tom stared out at the crowd, looking for anyone stopping to listen, before turning his attention to Rand and Matt. His blue eyes bored into theirs, between flickering away to watch the mouth of the alley.
"Don't ever say that name where strangers can hear."
His voice was low but urgent.
"Not even where a stranger might hear. It is a very dangerous name. Even where children of the light are not wandering the streets."
Matt snorted.
"I could tell you about children of the light," he said with a wry look at Rand.
Tom ignored him.
"If only one of you had had this dream."
He tugged at his mustache furiously.
"Tell me everything you can remember about it. Every detail."
He kept up his wary watch while he listened.
"He named the men he said had been used," Rand said finally.
He thought he had told everything else.
"Gwer Amalasan, Rowland Darkspane. Davian," Matt added before he could go on, "and Urien Stonebow. And Loghain," Rand finished.
"Dangerous names," Tom muttered.
His eyes seemed to drill at them even more intently than before.
"Nearly as dangerous as that other, one way and another. All dead now, except for Loghain. Some long dead. Rowland Darkspane, nearly 2,000 years. But dangerous just the same. Best you don't say them aloud even when you're alone. Most people wouldn't recognize a one of them, but if the wrong person overhears..."
"But who were they?" Rand said.
"Men," Tom murmured. "Men who shook the pillars of heaven and rocked the world on its foundations."
He shook his head.
"It doesn't matter. Forget about them. They are dust now."
Were they used, like you said? Matt asked. "And killed?"
"You might say the White Tower killed them. You might say that."
Tom's mouth tightened momentarily. Then he shook his head again.
"But used? No, I cannot see that. The light knows the Amarin seat has enough plots going, but I can't see that."
Matt shivered.
"He said so many things. Crazy things. All that about Luz, Theron Kinslayer, and Arta Hawkwing, and the Eye of the World? What in the light is that supposed to be?"
"A legend," the gleeman said slowly. "Maybe. As big a legend as the Horn of Valir, at least in the Borderlands. Up there, young men go hunting the Eye of the World, the way young men from Ilion hunt the Horn. Maybe a legend."
"What do we do, Tom?" Rand said. "Do we tell her? I don't want any more dreams like that. Maybe she could do something."
"Maybe we wouldn't like what she did," Matt growled.
Tom studied them, considering and stroking his mustache with a knuckle.
I say hold your peace, he said finally. Don't tell anyone, for the time at least. You can always change your mind, if you have to. But once you tell, it's done. And you're tied up worse than ever with her.
Suddenly he straightened, his stoop almost disappearing.
The other lad. You say he had the same dream. Does he have sense enough to keep his mouth shut?
I think so,
Rand said, at the same time that Matt said. We were going back to the inn to warn him.
The lights end, we're not too late.
Cloak flapping around his ankles, patches fluttering in the wind, Tom strode out of the alley, looking back over his shoulder without stopping.
Well, are your feet pegged to the ground?
Rand and Matt hurried after him, but he did not wait for them to catch up. This time he did not pause for people who looked at his cloak or those who hailed him as a gleeman either. He clove through the crowded streets as if they were empty, Rand and Matt half running to follow in his wake. In much less time than Rand expected, they were hurrying up to the Stag and Lion. As they started in, Perrin came speeding out, trying to throw his cloak around his shoulders as he ran. He nearly fell in his effort not to carom into them.
I was coming looking for you two,
he panted, when he had caught his balance. Rand grabbed him by the arm.
Did you tell anyone about the dream? Say that you didn't, Matt demanded.
It's very important, Tom said.
Perrin looked at them in confusion.
No, I haven't.
I didn't even get out of bed until less than an hour ago.
His shoulders slumped.
I've given myself a headache trying not to think about it, much less talk about it.
Why did you tell him?
He nodded at the gleeman.
We had to talk to somebody or go crazy, Rand said.
I will explain later,
Tom added, with a significant look at the people passing in and out of the Stag and Lion.
All right,
Perrin replied slowly, still looking confused. Suddenly, he slapped his head.
You almost made me forget why I was looking for you. Not that I don't wish I could. Nynaeve is inside.
Blood and ashes, Matt yelped. How did she get here? Moraine, the fairy.
Perrin snorted.
You think a little thing like a sunken fairy could stop her? She rooted Hightower out. I don't know how he got back over the river. But she said he was hiding in his bedroom and didn't want to go near the river. Anyway, she bullied him into finding a boat big enough for her and her horse and rowing her across. Himself.
She only gave him time to find one of his haulers to work another set of oars.
Light,
Matt breathed.
What is she doing here?
Rand wanted to know. Matt and Perrin both gave him a scornful look.
She came after us, Perrin said. She's with Mistress Alice right now. And it's cold enough in there to snow.
Couldn't we just go somewhere else for a while? Matt asked. My Da says only a fool puts his hand in a hornet nest until he absolutely has to.
Rand cut in.
She can't make us go back. Winter night should have been enough to make her see that. If she doesn't, we will have to make her.
Matt's eyebrows lifted higher with every word, and when Rand finished, he let out a low whistle.
You ever try to make Nynaeve see something she doesn't want to see? I have. I say we stay away till night and sneak in then.
From my observation of the young woman, Tom said, I don't think she will stop until she has had her say. If she is not allowed to have it soon, she might keep on until she attracts attention none of us wants.
That brought them all up short.
They exchanged glances, drew deep breaths, and marched inside as if to face Trollocs.